Mark's Gospel, chapter 6. In Mark, in his Gospel, his little booklet of good news about Jesus Christ, we are invited to be one of Jesus' disciples. We are brought through the testimony that Mark's recorded, which we think comes down right from the apostles, probably from Peter himself. We're invited to walk with Jesus through those key training events that he used with his disciples, so that we too would experience them, so that we can learn what they learned, that their discipleship training can be handed on to us, so that we can know what we need to know if we would have a place in the eternal kingdom of God. What have we learned about that kingdom in recent sermons? Well, we've thought back in chapter 5, various lessons. We've thought about how Jesus' kingdom produces a multiplicity of fruit. That, in other words, it grows in all kinds of ways, even though it faces rejection. His disciples had to understand that. They were going to experience rejection. They could feel, is this going to go anywhere in the end? Or are we just going to lose everything? And Jesus taught them and showed them, no, it's going to be multiplied. It's going to be a grand kingdom. And indeed, it's become that 2,000 years on. What a comparison between what it was there when Jesus was stood in Capernaum and what it is now. Of course, what it will be greater still when he returns, when it's seen in all its glory. We've seen also that Jesus welcomes all with faith in him. That it's not a case of he was selectively looking for suitable people, the type of people that could help him with his task. Anyone who comes to him with faith in him, no matter what the world thinks of them, can find forgiveness for their sin and a place in his kingdom. He welcomes whoever they are. You remember the woman in the crowd, invisible to everyone, unwanted by everyone, touching out for him. Then last time we thought of the private resurrection of Jairus' daughter and how that miracle, and other miracles indeed, display the fullness of life which the kingdom restores. Sin has created ruin. Jesus brings back life. Those who trust in him find life restored to them, in part now, fully at the resurrection. So those are things we thought of in recent sermons. Now, as we've watched Jesus going about laying out these foundations, laying out these core ideas through his actions and his words and his teachings and the things they go through, as we've watched him carefully lay the foundations of God's kingdom, one of the things we've had to notice is not only is he rejected, but he's also often misunderstood. And again, it just shows why Jesus had to so carefully train his disciples to prepare them for this kingdom. It was not going to be an easy matter, just sort of launch it, get your advertising right, set it up, all goes well. Here you had the greatest speaker of all history, the finest man of all history, and he could be misheard and he could be misunderstood. And so we've seen that in previous sections, and we're going to see it again in the section we're looking at. He actually said it in a parable, didn't he? Again, we come back to what we thought about before. The parable of the four land types, where the sower's casting out his seed. And the first land type was just hardened path, where the seed does nothing but bounce, and then birds eat it. He said then, there will be people, and it doesn't matter how profoundly and how clearly I speak to them, I will have no effect on them whatsoever. Zero impact. His disciples had to understand that. They were going to see him. They were going to hear him. You could imagine them, couldn't you? You could imagine them in some crowd and he preaches something, he says something, and the disciples are saying, I've never heard anything like that. That's amazing. And meanwhile, there's a grumbling group over to their right, haven't got a word of it, no idea what he's going on about, and it feels like, did they not hear? But Jesus said, look, it's going to be like that. For some people, it's going to be like seed on a path. I can say what I like, it will bounce off them. No impact. And the disciples need to be aware of that. And our verses are going to give us a shocking example of that. And it will happen as Jesus goes home. Of all places where you might think he would be understood. Where was Jesus' home? I'm sure you know, and Christmas wasn't that long ago. Out of legal necessity, Jesus was born in Bethlehem. His stepfather, Joseph, chose to take his mother, Mary, down to Bethlehem when she was due to give birth. He wanted the boy registered as of the line of David. There was going to be a formal registration process across the country going on, triggered by a census. And so, legally, Jesus is born down in Bethlehem. Then, there was a persecution that broke out against young children because King Herod was paranoid about Jesus' birth. So, he then moved to Egypt as a youngster. His mum and dad took him down there to live for a while. However, finally he returned and they went to live where Joseph came from. And that's sort of where we think of as Jesus' home, isn't it? They go back to Nazareth. And in this these verses, Jesus goes back to Nazareth. In his adult life, he would sometimes be known as Jesus of Nazareth. That's regarded as his home. It's a town up in the north of what we think of as Israel. It's a town in an area that was thought of as much more sort of dodgy and ropey. At one point, Nazareth is criticised. What good comes from there? That's where he's going to in Mark 6. So, we're going to watch him go back. He's been away for a time. He's been involved in all kinds of activity, his ministry, his kingdom building, his discipleship training. Now he's going home. And we're going to look at this under three headings: an uneasy visit, a lack of understanding, and a sad separation. Uneasy visit. Mark 6, verse 1. Jesus left there and went to his hometown, accompanied by his disciples. Now that sounds completely innocuous, doesn't it? I mean, you expected to read that, didn't you? Jesus, well, of course, would have gone with his disciples. He's always got his disciples with him. They follow him everywhere. They learn from him everywhere. He's accompanied by his disciples. But if we've been following Mark's gospel, we're going to realise that some warning bells are being triggered here. You remember what happened back in chapter 3? Chapter 3 is the chapter where Jesus appointed his disciples, 12 of them. We were given their names and everything. It's as though a family was being set up, given their names. 2 verses later, though, Jesus' family turn up and say, "We should take you home. You shouldn't be hanging around with these people anymore. It's not doing you any good. We think you're having a breakdown. You need to come home." It says in the verse that he hadn't been eating properly. He and his disciples had been so pushed and stressed by activity, they hadn't had a chance to eat. He's the popular rabbi. And so the family look at him, they think, you've gone a bit weird. Ever since that baptism by John the Baptist, something's not been right. You need to come home. As you see what his family were doing, this is his mother and his brothers, they're looking at Jesus and they're saying, you're not what we expect. You're being influenced by unhealthy influences. Have got a grip on you. You need to pull away. You need to get away. But then, towards the end of the chapter, when the family are finally actually standing outside the door, waiting for him so that they can go, what does Jesus do? They call him outside, and he stays inside where the disciples are and others. And then in that group, he has the cheek to say this: "Those who do the will of God are my mother and my brothers and my sisters." He looks around the room and there are older women there and there are various men there, young and old, and there are younger women there. And he says, "These people who want to learn from me the will of God, this is my family." Now, do you see why it's a little bit tricky to turn up in Nazareth with his disciples? Why it might be a little bit uncomfortable? given the way Martha's told us the story, can you imagine how much antagonism could be felt in that town by his attitude? Your family came for you, and you put them to shame. Your family came for you, and you embarrassed them. Maybe if it had said, and Jesus went to Nazareth, but he left his disciples in Capernaum. Maybe then we could understand he's trying to sort of ease his way back in with those who might be upset with him. But turning up with the disciples, it's like rubbing salt in a wound. Now, as Christians, of course, we're conscious of the wider picture. And so we sort of wonder, really, well, why would this be a problem? You know, I've read Matthew and Luke and, surely everybody knew about Jesus. I mean, they knew about his birth and that miraculous virgin conception and the angels who came and talked to Mary and Joseph and shepherds out on the hillside. And I mean, surely his family know he's the special one. Well, they should do. But the problem is, as I said just now, Jesus, even if they accept he's special, isn't meeting their expectations. He's not being what they want. That's why they went to get him. He should be the sort of Messiah they're expecting, not the sort of Messiah he's turning out to be. And maybe especially in a Jewish culture, he really ought to understand the significant importance of family and hometown and not creating this atmosphere of pushing them away. So yes, maybe they did, in the family, have some consciousness of there's something special about Jesus. But they don't understand the nature of God's kingdom and what it is and how radical it is, how transformative it is. How it builds new family, eternal family. And the town where he grew up certainly didn't understand. Because that's the story. You know, any group. So, you know, blood family, group of relatives, or a community somewhere, a village or whatever it may be, or a church, or a nation. Any group of people can build up a set of assumptions about life, how they think of life, how life should function, what life's about, and it just seems obvious to them. It seems completely obvious. Obvious what sort of clothes you wear, obvious what sort of food you eat, obvious what sort of patterns of life you have, obvious how you greet people when you meet them, obvious your expectations of youngsters amongst you and of older people. It's just obvious. It's just, that's what life's like. And it's obviously right. And so you hear people say things like, well, in this family we do because that's what you do. Or in this church we do because that's what you do. It's obvious, isn't it? Or on the grander scale, people talk about society's values as though we're all commonly agreed that there's a set of assumptions about how to live and we all know what they are. Now, to the people inside the group, the assumptions are obviously right. They're not things you discuss, they're just obvious. It's what you do, it's how life works. You don't need to discuss them, everyone should just do them. Which makes us close-minded often. We actually can't see other ways to do things because there's obviously only one way. It's what we do. Bizarrely, you can often find people proclaiming this and being close-minded at the very moment when they say they're being open-minded. So you can get sort of societies that say, well, we're a very open society, you know, where people can hold all types of views about things. And then you say, oh, right, well, this is my view. Well, you can't hold that. Oh, so we're not so open-minded after all, then. Groups do this. Families do this. Churches do this. Nations do this. Communities do this. They think they know what life is. And it just becomes completely assumed. And then anybody who doesn't match the assumptions, they're shaking their heads. Well, there's something wrong here then. Not, oh, this is very different, we should talk about this. Why? No, this person's just, they just don't see it. Maybe they're just arrogant. They're so full of themselves. Maybe they're hateful. Maybe there's something, they've got something against our society or our community or our family or our church. Or if they come from the family, oh, I think they're like a traitor. Do they not care what we think? This happens. It's a very nasty trait, and it's all too common. It was there in Nazareth. It led to, second point, a lack of understanding. Let's watch it in action. Verse 2, when the Sabbath came, Jesus began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were amazed. Where did this man get these things? They asked. Jesus is a rabbi, and he goes to the synagogue, which is a hall where the Jews in the village or the town have gathered to worship, and he gets to speak because he's a rabbi and he's visiting, and so he's invited to say something. But people react very strongly to what he says. It's not just a sort of, you know, visiting preacher, lovely word, brother, off you go. They're reacting strongly. This is too much for them. Where's all this coming from, they ask. This wisdom that has been given him, that he even does miracles or acts of power. Wisdom is to learn about life, isn't it? To know how to live. They say, well, where's all this coming from? He's telling us about life. Well, we know about life. Where's all this coming from? What's he coming up with? Rumours of his work will no doubt have reached Nazareth. They'll have heard about things he's been saying and doing elsewhere. But you know what rumours are like? There's all kinds of Chinese whispers going on. Who knows what's been actually said about him in Nazareth by this time? And of course, the family's visit, well, who knows how that's gone round the town? Maybe when Mary explained it, she explained it in a very balanced way. By the time it was five doors down, it had turned into all kinds of stuff. And these people react. Who does he think he is? Where's this coming from, what he's going on about? Jesus has been impressing elsewhere with powerful acts, what we would call miracles. But in that town, they're saying, well, it's all a bit odd, isn't it? Because we're not really sure where this is coming from. How's he doing it? Why are they so cynical? You know, isn't this, you know, one of the boys of the town come home with a grand reputation? Apparently not. Because he's not being what they want. He's being his own man. He's saying what God is actually doing. Do you remember how he described? My family are those who do the will of God. Well, the implication is that when he speaks in that synagogue, that maybe there are people whom he's either directly or at least indirectly rebuking because they're not doing the will of God. Where's he get this from? He doesn't meet their assumptions. He doesn't meet their expectations. He's not being loyal to the group. He's letting them down. What do they say? Verse 3. Isn't this the carpenter? This lad grew up among us. There were no big works then. We didn't used to go in the workshop and say, I'd like a new sickle, please, Jesus. And he'd go, bow, there we are. He'd work for a few days and then deliver the sickle to us. He was in his workshop and his dad was there, Joseph. And they were making our farm tools and they were making our kitchen utensils. There were no big works then. He's just the carpenter. Isn't this Mary's son and the brother of James, Joseph, Judas and Simon? Aren't his sisters here with us? This is the child who played with us, called us his friends, called us his uncles and aunties. This is the lad who learned at the synagogue with the rest. This is the lad who worked with his family on their little plot of land, their small holding, to grow their food. He didn't do big works then. He didn't feed his family by some sort of mysterious delivery of bread. He's God above himself. He's Mary's son, they say. We know his brothers and sisters. It's noticeable, isn't it, how Mark includes that quote. In chapter 3, Jesus said, "Those who do God's will are my mother and brothers and sisters." Now the Nazareth locals say, "We know who his mother is. She's called Mary. And we know who his brothers are because we know their names. They're called Judas and Simon and Joseph and James. And we know who his sisters are." In the background, there's almost, you can almost feel an undercurrent of the word traitor, can't you? Who is this man? How dare he come here and be like this? They took offence at him. The phrase Mary's son has caused lots of discussion over the years amongst people studying the Bible. It seems it is here to link us back to chapter 3, to form that connection with the last way in which Jesus reacted to his family. But it's unusual to use the phrase, son of Mary. You don't normally talk of an Israelite or a Jewish man in that way. You would call him son of Joseph. Even if Joseph was dead, he's still the son of Joseph. It seems likely Joseph is dead because he doesn't appear, does he? But you'd still call him the son of Joseph. There are some who say that it might be that the folk in Nazareth are being nasty about Jesus' parentage. There's the question of who's the real dad. Mary's always been very reticent to describe exactly where she got this boy from. Maybe there's something of that. Oh yeah, he's Mary's son because we don't really know who his dad is, do we? That could be there, and some people think it may be. Others suggest it's a different explanation. That, in fact, Joseph was an older man, and he does appear to be an older man in the accounts. And, in fact, he'd been married before, presumably then became a widower. And so they say, well, Jesus' brothers and sisters being mentioned are actually older than him, and they're his step-siblings. You know, his stepbrother and his stepsisters. And so, therefore, you distinguish Jesus by saying he's Mary's son, as opposed to the children of whatever the first wife was called. Now, I don't know, both are possible. The passage doesn't give us the details, but you might, in reading some books, come across those possibilities. Certainly, it does seem at points, in regard to the first one, that people did question Jesus' parentage. We know that there were issues of, was he the child of some Roman that had impregnated Mary? You remember in one discussion, when Jesus is really having an argument with, I think it's the Pharisees, and they say, well, we know who our father is. And you can hear the undercurrent of questioning. But anyway, what is clear in the story is this. The locals say, we know you. Stop getting ideas above your station, young fella. We know you. We know who you are. We know what to expect from you. It's very painful when this occurs, isn't it? When we find that those whom naturally we expect to love us best are the very people who push us away. You know, when a child just keeps away from the parents, saying, you've never understood me. When actually it's the child that doesn't understand the parent. Or the other way around, when a parent cuts a child out of their life saying, how could you act that way towards me? When in fact it's the parent who misbehaved. These situations, they are so painful and they happen. Of course, in our world there are many things which separate people, many ugly sins and all kinds of things. But failure to communicate, failure to speak to one another, failure to understand one another and make sense of one another, that can be really hard. For those of us who experience that, we come to a passage like Mark 6 and we look at Jesus and we say, he understands. He went home And Holmes said, "Who are you?" He empathises with us. He understands what we go through when we're being hurt by those who really should love us best. Jesus understands that because he took that trip back to Nazareth. Which brings us to the third part of the sermon, which is then to go into the verses about sad separation. Jesus, verse 4, said to them, only in his hometown, among his relatives, and in his own house, is a prophet without honour. Jesus shakes his head. You are such typical Israelites. Whenever God sends somebody to speak with you, a prophet, you never understand them. Prophets did come again and again to Israel, and so many of them were treated badly and ignored and not listened to. You notice how Jesus uses that phrase that, as it were, is like a camera lens that zooms in. Only in his hometown is a prophet despised. Starts with that. He puts it just on the sort of, just on the town level, what he's just experienced. Those he grew up with find it hardest to accept the message he preaches, because they think they know him, but they don't. Because they want him to match their ideals and assumptions, and he doesn't. But in fact, says Jesus, it's not just my hometown, it's among my relatives. Even the relatives don't listen properly to me. We used to go to festivals together. We used to take pilgrimage to Jerusalem together. I used to go around their house for tea. And they don't understand. And in his own house. It's a lovely feeling if you can go back to your own home and feel relaxed. Not just if you've been away a long time, but even just, you know, at the end of a working day. It's a really horrible feeling if every time you go back to your home, you're waiting to be uncomfortable. Because you know it's going to be difficult. Jesus says, even in my home. He says, but this is so typical. This is just the history of Israel. The prophets aren't accepted. I should have, yeah, it's just Jesus shrugging, isn't it, and saying, I should have known. Well, in fact, he did know, but you see what I mean. I should have known. It's just always the way, isn't it? You can be in your own house with the people you live with and they don't listen to you. It's horribly painful, but it was proved true over and over again in Israel. And of course, it's a reflection not just of Jesus' experience or human experience, but of God's experience with Israel. Because God's the one who speaks through the prophets. Jesus will later say of Jerusalem, won't he? I pleaded with you to listen, and you do not. It's the effect of sin. It's what we all need forgiveness for, but here it's particularly intensely highlighted. The despising of God speaking to us, the failure to listen. Mark gives us a little verse that shows us what it looked like on the ground. He could not do any miracles there except lay his hands on a few sick people and heal them. Mark's point is that just no one comes and asks him for help. Just literally no one comes. He goes anywhere else in Galilee, people flock to him. There are people stretching out to touch him in the crowd. In fact, it becomes so complicated, he has to manage them all very carefully. Not overdo the miracles, but Nazareth, the opposite. Anyone going down to see Jesus? Oh, no, I've got to stay in to wash my hair this evening. Nobody goes. Well, Mark says a few really sick people sought him out because they were desperate, and he healed them. But the rest of the town asks for nothing, wants nothing. Doesn't trust him. He treated us badly. Forget him. And so verse 6. And he was amazed at their lack of faith. And then Jesus went round teaching from village to village. Jesus, again, just shakes his head and says to the disciples, let's go down the road. Let's go and see the others in the village nearby. We're not getting anywhere. This is going nowhere. Jesus knew it would happen because it's a proverbial statement. Even in his own town, a prophet isn't heard. Even his own family, but he still sighs over it. People can hold such grudges, hold on to such resentment, be so bitter. It's almost unbelievable what human beings will hold on to. Jesus does mighty deeds elsewhere, and they're still so narked at him that it's a case of, don't bother here, we don't need them. Well, as we wrap up, what can we learn from it just to take with us? In the example of the Lord Jesus, of course, we see that a Christian is called to humility, but don't be surprised if you get accused of false modesty. It is humble, isn't it, of Jesus to go to Nazareth? He goes there to serve others. He goes there for good reason, for good purpose. He goes there to speak the word of God. And he goes there willing to do good amongst those folk, willing to use his power. But they just think he's pretending and they write him off. He's not really thinking of us. He's just bigging himself up. Who is he? Where's he get this wisdom? Oh, what's these big deeds he does? He's the carpenter. False modesty is it's a poor trait. It's where we put our sails down, desperately hoping that other people will notice us. Other people will praise us. For some of us, it arises from our insecurities. So we put our sails down in the hope somebody else goes, no, not at all. Others, obviously, it stems from arrogance. We're just manipulating people. But humility is the true and real godlike desire to put others first. Jesus isn't showing false modesty here. He has come to them humbly. Jesus doesn't hide who he is. He does have profound words to speak. He doesn't hide that away and go, no, I've not really got anything to say. He does have great power to use. He can do miracles. He can command as king. He knows he's the Christ. But he always acts in a humble way. He seeks to put others first. He doesn't promote himself for personal gain. But these people misread him. Oh, that's all he's here for. Who does he think he is? With his big words and his big actions. He's the carpenter. So, as you watch Jesus here, don't be surprised if, as a Christian, you try to emulate his humility, but it sometimes get a bad response. And linked to that is, understand secondly, just the power of resentment. It's the sin that's visible here, isn't it? In the minds of the town, Jesus put his family to shame. He embarrassed them. Well, since he dishonoured them, they'll dishonour him. New Christians can find this. Somebody freshly converted can suddenly find their family or their community turns on them. You're a traitor. You've been disloyal to us. You know, sometimes you can sadly hear it among Christians. Christians sort of deploying that argument. You've let me down. Well, we have to take great care. When a Christian friend or a Christian pastor or a Christian preacher says something that you don't like, and you find yourself saying back to them, well, who is she to say that? Well, you stop. And you make ever so sure that you're not just doing a Nazareth on them. You listen to yourself if you say, who is she to say that? Are you certain before God you're not doing a Nazareth? Now, maybe she is wrong. And she shouldn't have said it. We do say wrong things. Preachers say wrong things. But it might be that you're just not willing to listen to something that is true to God, but you don't want to hear. And you really don't want to hear it from somebody you know. But you should. It's a very sad and a very dangerous place to be, to find yourself caught in a Nazareth. And then lastly, to finish off, aim for humility, don't be surprised by false being accused of false modesty. Understand the power of resentment. But finally, positively, just go back to the Saviour again and love his example here, because it is a beautiful thing that he does. It would have been so easy to stay away from home, wouldn't it? He knew this was coming. And, you know, if you know that you're going to get cut and punched and kicked, even if not literally, why go there? It's much easier to stay away. This was never going to end well. He already knew the proverbial statement before he got there. He didn't make it up on the spur of the moment. He knew this was coming. Or he could have left his disciples elsewhere, like I said, made his life simple, just turned up by himself. Or he could have flattered people by turning up in the town and just going around doing all sorts of miracles immediately, not waiting to see if they reacted to him or not. But he just won't play people. Jesus just doesn't manipulate people like that. He wants truth in all his relationships with others. He wants to know, he wants his old friends, he wants his cousins, he wants his aunts, he wants his grandparents. To know him as he is. And to have faith in him as he is. Not as they want him to be. So he won't hide from them. And that's very bold, isn't it? And it's very loving. That he goes back home, knowing how they'll probably treat him. But he still goes. He puts himself out in order to love them and bring the gospel to them, even though it will fail. And that's something greatly to be delighted in with the Lord Jesus, something to be admired, an example to follow in how we react to others, isn't it? And a reassurance for ourselves that actually in those times in our lives where maybe we have pushed Jesus away with words like this, he will come back again. So just make sure you're ready this time to welcome him and not drive him away.